I'm David Johnson. I'm the president and CEO of the Central Indiana Corporate Partnership and BioCrossroads. And I frankly have lost track of how many framework seminars we've done this year, but this is the biggest one we've had in quite a while. And a great group, a great crowd. Some of you we've seen many times here before, and some of you we haven't seen before. So welcome. This is a great discussion, a great program, and I'm strongly believing the first of several we will have on this very important topic. I want to give a special greeting and acknowledgement to our Lieutenant Governor, Dr. Sue Elsperman, who is here this morning to participate in this program. It's very important to have Dr. Elsperman here. And Lieutenant Governor, though, does have a very hard stop at around 9 o'clock, I believe, this morning. So that means that I need to speak pretty quickly, and so does Rob Smith. So we'll figure all that out. So I will speak quickly. You have on your chairs this morning, in addition to the material from the program, again, thanks to Miles Printing and Purdue for sponsoring us today, you have a little insert that's a list. I've got the long form of it, but it's a list of something called advanced industries. That's really important work, and it's recent work that's been put out by Brookings Institution. We're going to be talking a lot more about that as a concept for all sorts of things in the area of economic development, workforce development, and talent. What Brookings has essentially done is to look across the country at industries that are growing, that represent, for example, where most engineers go, where most patents come from. And rather than looking at a series of clusters like life sciences or information technology or clean tech, they're saying, what do these industries have in common that is allowing them to grow and really be the industries of the future? And the two numbers that they've looked at for setting up this index for the companies and the codes that you're looking at there are, first, does the industry spend an outside dollar figure per worker on research and development? So whether they're doing products or services, are they inventing? Are they innovative? Are they looking to do new things? And secondly, if you work at one of these companies, is it more likely than not that you have to have appropriate STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math credentials to get a job there? And they overlay those two factors, STEM preparedness and research and development, and come up with a great list. And if you look at that list and you ask yourself, what do we do in Indiana? It's almost everything here that we do. So that means that STEM has moved from being just in the past 10 years that many of us have been talking about it, and this is really more on the BioCrossroads side of the street, because BioCrossroads began through my colleague Ann Shane a decade ago now, the iSTEM initiative with the wonderful help of Lilly Endowment, the involvement of the state of Indiana, our friends at Lilly Company Foundation and Rolls-Royce and Cummins and Cook. And the idea back then was life sciences jobs are the jobs of the future. Our kids are not going to be able to have those jobs unless they get the right kind of education. We need to have some sort of educational program that really focuses on that. And that is more true today than ever. But what is also true is now it is not just about, really never was, but it is clearly not just about the life sciences. It's about pretty much everything we do in the state. And so the purpose of today's discussion is to bring this audience, many of you are deeply engaged in these topics, but to bring you together and to begin a process of coming together to really talk about STEM education as the gateway to preparedness for this state for the 21st century and for the opportunities that we have right here, right now, with the companies and services that we do, but we are not yet really preparing our children to be able to pursue them in the years to come. And how are we going to do that? How are we going to get that done? It will take not only the efforts that many of you here today have done, it's going to take more. And I don't just mean more money. I mean more collaboration. This is really the time when all of the private sector, philanthropic sector, corporate engagement, and state need to come together to have a really serious, focused, outcome-driven conversation to figure out where this state and its supporting private and philanthropic sectors are going to go on this vitally important topic. So to begin that conversation today, I want to introduce, for his very brief opening remarks, my colleague Rob Smith, who many of you know from Eli Lilly and Company. Rob is the president of the Lilly Company Foundation, among many other great responsibilities he has there, and has been a passionate advocate for STEM, and I suspect you're going to hear some passion right now. Thank you. Great.
Thank you, David, very much. Good to see you. Thank you. I just cut two paragraphs out of the comments real time. So hopefully I will be very brief. David, thank you very much for the introduction, and thank you for all the leadership that you've provided and continue to provide for our state. Thank you very much. And thank you all for being here, ladies and gentlemen. This is a great turnout. I really appreciate your attendance. As you all know, I mean, we're living through incredibly dynamic times right now with the exponential advancements that we've seen with technology. Our lives and our entire economy have been transformed in the last generation. I mean, think about where we were 20 years ago and where we are now. I mean, the changes have been absolutely astonishing. And there's no sign that these forces of technology, along with globalization, will abate at any time soon. And on balance, I think this is very exciting. I think that humanity is going to continue to develop the tools to conquer new frontiers, to be able to solve some of the big challenges that we face in areas like where we work in healthcare. So I think this is an incredibly exciting time, and it's going to create a lot of economic opportunity for people around the world. But we also know that this is going to create and has created real disruption and real displacement for a lot of people. And I think all of us have to ask the question, what does the state of Indiana and Hoosiers have to do to be competitive in this dynamic economy? And while this is a very complex question with many variables, needless to say, I think one thing that we have to agree on is that we have to dramatically improve the educational attainment of all Hoosiers, and that STEM has to be a fundamental component of that. To be competitive, and David referenced this in his comments, to be competitive for jobs in the 21st century, Hoosiers are going to have to increasingly have, at a minimum, basic skills when they graduate from high school in math and science, and they're going to have the skills and motivation to be able to pursue some form of post-secondary education or training or certification to be competitive, again, for the jobs that are going to pay well, jobs that they can support their families. And at the same time, we need to also excite the young kids as they grow older who want to pursue professional careers in STEM. We need to excite them, we need to motivate them, and then we need to properly train them. And regarding STEM, a lot of good work has been done over the last few years in the state of Indiana. David mentioned the iSTEM Resource Network, for example. I think they have done really good work and have advanced the ball in many ways. But I think what we have to do next as a state is to do the hard work necessary to develop a statewide STEM strategy that is very inclusive of the education community, the business community, state government, philanthropic sectors, where we can better align for collective action. I think we face right now a lot of opportunities where we have 1,000 points of STEM around the state of Indiana, and all these things are nice, but I think that we need to increasingly have collective action, and there's no substitute, I think, for a statewide state strategy with the right parties involved. And we'll talk a little bit about that in the panel discussion. We will save that for then. So I'm going to stop with my comments now because I'm my clock says 2 minutes. So I think I'm doing well. Either that or it's running slowly. So I'm going to stop with my opening comments. We'll be able to get into a lot of these topics during our panel discussion. So let me turn this over now to our Lieutenant Governor, and let me make a brief introduction of her. I have the privilege of introducing Lieutenant Governor today. And by way of background, Lieutenant Governor Sue Elsperman serves as President of the Indiana Senate and Secretary of Agriculture and Rural Development. She manages six state agencies, including the State Department of Agriculture and the Office of Business and Small Business and Entrepreneurship, as well as chairing the Indiana Counterterrorism and Security Council. Lieutenant Governor was born and raised in the town of Ferdinand in Du Bois County in southwestern Indiana. Lieutenant Governor has a bachelor's degree in industrial engineering from Purdue University. After an early career in manufacturing at General Motors in Michelin and Frito-Lay, she returned to Evansville and started a consulting business. And very impressively, she completed a master's and doctoral degree in industrial engineering from the University of Louisville. She was elected to the Indiana House of Representatives in 2010 and served as vice chair of the Employment, Labor, and Pension Committee and was member of the Small Business, Commerce, and Economic Development Elections and Apportionment Committees while serving in the legislative body. And very relevant to our discussion today, she is vice chair of the Indiana Career Council that is leading the state's workforce development, education, and training initiatives. Please join me in welcoming to the podium Lieutenant Governor Sue Elsperman. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob. It is a real pleasure to be with all the folks in the room today. I know many of you, a number of you, we get to work together, but this is, as you heard from David and you heard from Rob, what an important discussion that you're having today and talking about how Indiana moves forward with STEM education and ensuring that we have a workforce that has those right STEM skills as we move forward. I know talking with this group is a little bit like preaching to the choir, though, because many of you understand the dilemma and the statistics and the challenges that go along with this, but I'm going to just share a few pieces to put it in perspective, and I'm going to begin with the person who's going to moderate for us a little bit later this morning, Dr. Vince Bertram, whom released a book recently called One Nation Undertaught, and I enjoyed that. If you haven't read it in this room, I'm just going to be your salesperson this morning. You need to read it. It's about a three-hour read. Yes, we can clap for that. It's an excellent, excellent guide, but focused on of many, many great pieces of information, insight, and wisdom in the book, the more than 1 million STEM jobs we will fall short over the next decades, so important for us as a nation to be thinking about. And in Indiana, we know that over 65% of our jobs in the next decade are going to require some kind of post-secondary education, skills, degrees. And more than half of those will fall under the broad umbrella of STEM. So important for us to think about. If some of you followed Indiana's Hot 50 Jobs, the DWD, Department of Workforce Development, puts out, that showed that over 50% of those jobs are directly related to STEM in the state, and another 10 of those had more dimensions related to STEM. So just as we see nationally, so we see here in Indiana. And as you heard referenced with those advanced industries, the Brookings Institution's report, I'm going to share one of their quotes. They said, "Our research makes clear that Indiana is no longer just a manufacturing province. The state's metropolitan economies are increasingly diversified with material, digital, and genomic specializations all at once." Really captures in Indiana. And they ranked Indiana fourth in the nation for advanced industries, and those lean heavily on STEM. So by whatever measure we look at, there's unquestionably an unfulfilled and increasing demand for employees that have those STEM-related knowledge, training, skills. And really thinking in that context, Governor and the General Assembly went about doing their work in 2013, which took this on head on, and the backbone of that is the Indiana Career Council, and I know we have a number of folks in the room who work with the Career Council, but it truly is the first time, at least in recent history, where we've brought educators, both K-12 and higher education, DWD, business, labor, all around the same table trying to figure out how we better align and coordinate activities for Indiana's education, job skills development, and career training systems, really ensuring alignment of those to meet the existing and future needs in Indiana. So here's an interesting stat that we discovered as we went about our work. 59% of our state budget was dedicated to education and workforce development, 59%. And the other interesting number, 30 different federal and state funding streams. That does not make things easy, right? That's just such a broad range. One of many things we looked at. So we spent more than a year planning and researching and finally adopting a strategic plan last June. And in that plan, we set the overarching goal, which was to have more than 60% of Indiana workforce to have post-secondary education training and certifications demanded in our economy within the decade. So if you think about where we are today, we're at about 34% of individuals having a 2 or 4 year degree. If we continue on our trajectory, we'll hit 41%. So getting up to 60% is still a big stretch, and we have much work still to do. We also had the regional works councils, the works councils, commissioned and shared with the Career Council future works work, where we took a snapshot of Indiana last year and really dug down to see was the demand, and how did that match or not match the supply in Indiana? And that provided some very important information in over 90 areas for us to understand how well we were doing. What were the areas, for instance, information technology, more than 10,000 jobs short across the state. And for those out in the industries, that's not a surprise to you. But a real concern is that we don't have a way to make up that kind of demand, and that's just one of the many STEM areas. Another focus of that strategic plan was, as you heard about those 30 different funding streams, how do we make that kind of model student and worker-centric? Because we're not just talking about the students coming out of school, but also the incumbent workers. How do we help bring them into a student and worker-centric model? For instance, research shows that student success is more than doubled when you provide a work and learn experience. And for those employers in the room, you know how important a tool like that is for retention of employees, for being able to recruit them in. So we set a stretch goal in that Career Council plan to do 10,000 more internships across the state of Indiana. You'll hear more about that shortly. In addition, the Commission for Higher Education said we've got to also look at those 675,000 Hoosiers who have part of a degree but have not yet completed. How do we help them complete at least an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree to bring them into those high-demand jobs? And in our research, we also learned, and I saw Amy here, the Indiana Chamber did a survey of our high school counselors. And how much time were they spending in career counseling? And probably not a surprise for those who are in education, that's less than half. And they're very, very busy doing a lot of other things. I'm married to a high school principal. I know all about that. But they are doing testing. They're doing traditional social work kind of counseling in the schools and all those other miscellaneous things that have to get done in a school day to day. And as a result, not having the kind of time they would like to have, as much time to do the career awareness that needs to be done with our students. And then we know there's more tools that we need to provide to make their time best used. We also heard, and we heard this in the listening sessions we did in the planning process across the state, that yes, there is a career counseling course, but it's in the CTE arena, and it's at high school. And we really need to be doing that career awareness building in middle school, so shifting the course down. And finally, getting all those students on a pathway in K-12, and as our universities are moving to meta majors as well, to help move our students in a logical fashion forward. And then finally, in the area of career and technical education, the research showed that concentration and completion of career and technical education pathways lead to higher wages if headed into the workforce and faster completion if you're going on for a 2 to 4 year degree. So work's underway to better align how our CTE is done, how those courses are done, to increase pay to the schools for the high demand, high wage kinds of jobs that are out there, as well as providing some outcome bonuses for students who concentrate or complete those certifications and credentials while they're in school. Now, having said all that, you'll recognize a lot of what I shared was not just unique to STEM. However, I think each one of them will help us to increase the pipeline of the STEM careers, particularly when we consider the role of programs like Project Lead the Way, that yes, it's often viewed in our career and technical education area, but it certainly drives the students and puts them in to many, many STEM professions. And universities remain perplexed on how to attract more students into their STEM programs. You know, I spent last week was National Engineers Week, so I was pretty excited. It was a great week for me. From the beginning to end, from the previous Saturday, speaking with my industrial engineering colleagues at Purdue to Friday, I spent with the IUPUI engineering technology program, and particularly their focus on attracting women into STEM. You know, their programs range from 2 to 10% female. Now, women, I always look at us in the room, I say, we're not a minority. What's this deal with 2 to 10%? Purdue Society of Women Engineers, of which I was one many years ago, Unum really has led the way nationally, moving the needle from about 10% back in the 70s when I was there up to now over 20%. But that's still a big gap when we consider how many we would like graduating. We would much rather see those in the 50% ranges. And yet, we're actually graduating more women from our universities today than men overall. So again, what's the deal here? Why are we not being successful? The interest of women in computer science is actually shrinking across the nation. That's a huge concern, particularly at a time when we have an ever greater need in the IT fields. So here's where I'm looking out to you all for help, because I know I've got a lot of industry folks in the group. You know, career counselors at the middle school, high school, and college levels really cannot tell the story of STEM the way you can as an industry leader. Experts tell us that the most effective tools for recruiting talent is through those work and learn experiences, or as many of us think of them as internships, or for me it was co-op when I was in school. These experiences really help our young people to appreciate the real world, and they get to see the applications real time, real life. The interns also learn what really interests them. I always told my own daughters, even if you didn't like it, you learned what you didn't like, right? Better you do that now than after a four-year degree and you find out you don't like the option that you chose. Again, I'm going to come back to that career council. We set a goal of 10,000 more internships in Indiana. And I know, and internet, you know, we're doing great things with internet, but we need the industries to really drive that. So I'm going to ask employers, we really need you to double down on our efforts around internships, and to offer those as well as the mentoring to the interns while they're there. Those co-op experiences I had at General Motors were invaluable. Five different experiences across different entities. At Frito-Lay, I ran their intern program one summer when I was part of my other duties there as an IE. And I'm going to put in a plug for the Career Council's work. We just completed, and you can get this hot off the press, right, PJ? We just completed your very own new guide as an employer on how to do a good work and learn experience, because it is not just completely intuitive. It does take a very thoughtful approach to making sure that we give, not only do we get the students in, but we give them a good experience and that there are some guidelines to follow along the way. So I'm going to ask you, we have to be part of the community to get it out. We as government can encourage, but you as industry really need to take the lead of getting our students into those experiences. And remember, that's your talent for the future as well. I also want to mention something that we call externships. And these are opportunities for teachers and counselors out there. I'm going to share one experience. When I was at the University of Southern Indiana, we have the same challenge in Southwest Indiana. Vince remembers, he used to be there. And so we developed a program one summer for the physics and math teachers in Southwest Indiana to go spend a week at Crane. Now, Crane is our crown jewel in Southern Indiana for high tech, you know, electronic warfare, night vision goggle work, radars, all kinds of cool stuff. So we thought if we could get our physics and math teachers in there to see what happens, they could see physics in action, and then bring that into the classroom and then be able to tell firsthand the stories. Just one example of what an externship might look like and what a difference we can make in our schools through those methods. And each of you, many of you in the industries, have those opportunities. So I ask you to work with local schools to bring educators into your facilities so they can see firsthand the kinds of jobs, the technologies, the opportunities that you have. Then they can bring those more meaningful conversations back into the students, with the students in their classrooms, and as counselors in the career planning. And at a personal level, I'm going to ask you to please consider to be a mentor. Be a mentor yourself to a young man or a young woman who really might not know yet where they want to go in their life's direction. I have signed on to champion the Million Women's Mentors Program. If you in the room may know what that is, it's a national program that's focused at identifying young men and women who will mentor young women in STEM. So we have a goal in Indiana. We've set a goal for 5,000 mentors. So some of you in this room also will get tapped on the shoulder again from me to be a part of that initiative. We need to be out there, and we need to be letting those young people know, reaching out to them, offering to be their mentors. I can pretty much assure you that I don't miss an opportunity in my office when I have fourth graders who are studying Indiana history, or I have high school students in all the time, or pages, or last afternoon a Christian school from Northeast Indiana in. I will shamelessly talk about STEM and their opportunities. And in that group last night, I had three that were going on into engineering. I rod them. You know, you got to do that, right? You got to do that. But I don't want us to ever underestimate how each of us makes a difference in that. That at the simplest level, our reaching out and showing our interest and encouraging them to take on those STEM careers is very, very important, or offering to allow them to job shadow you down the road. I commend our universities, our schools, and our nonprofits for the plethora of programs that we've talked about in STEM that they're offering across from camps and programs all around STEM. They are making a difference. And Lilly Endowment and Lilly Foundation both, and many represented in this room, are part of making that difference. But as I heard here today, we have more to do. Our solution for meeting the STEM crisis does need to be multifaceted, with the obvious leadership role of our education system. But in a larger sense, we also need to recognize the roles of other groups, the parents, the mentors, the employers, and the community leaders. The economy of Indiana and the future of our children really rests on the work that we're doing here. So thank you so much for your efforts. All right. With that, I think I'm at zero. So it's time for me to make my exit. But before I exit, I get the great privilege of introducing someone that I've gotten to know down in southern Indiana very well when he served as our superintendent of schools for EVSC. But Dr. Vince Bertram is the president and the CEO of Project Lead the Way, nation's leading provider of K-12 science, technology, engineering, and math curriculum. Since he joined Project Lead the Way in June 2011, the organization has grown to 6,500 schools. And I know that because as I visit with my lieutenant governors from across the country, they're all talking about Project Lead the Way. And I know Vince's great work there. He's trained thousands of teachers and received numerous national recognitions, awards, and partner support. Vince himself is really recognized as a thought leader. I already told you about the book that he recently published. In 2014, he was appointed by the U.S. Department of State to serve as an education expert for its United States Speaker and Specialist Program. He's testified before the U.S. House and is a frequent contributor to the Huffington Post. His new book really has taken a lot of us by storm. Very excited. Steve Forbes, chairman and editor-in-chief of Forbes Media, wrote about the book. He said, Dr. Bertram provides a blueprint for enabling students to fall in love with STEM subjects, subjects that don't have to be dreary or intimidating. He shows how teachers can break away from a rut of traditional teaching and kindle a kid's curiosity that will lead them to becoming passionate about learning. So with that, would you join me in welcoming Dr. Vince Bertram, CEO and President, Project Lead the Way, to moderate us forward.
Lieutenant Governor, thank you. One of the things that I really found in her remarks as she's leaving, you know, you want to hear this because I know. You know, there's a difference in people lamenting the problems. There's another in providing leadership and solutions. And what you heard today was a solution and how we can align our work across the state to continue to distinguish the state, not only in STEM, but in education. And Lieutenant Governor, thank you so much for your leadership. Thank you. You know, as we start our panel, there are a couple things I do want to mention is, and things I've heard from, you know, David and Rob are great leaders in our state and are really helping advance this work. You know, while we talk about vertical alignment, there's also this horizontal coordination that's critical. that's not just a matter of in communities connecting K-12 schools to higher education and to employers, but it's also important for employers to coordinate and to have a common voice, a common vision that really can drive this work and send a signal to our students that this work really matters. You go back several years, even the last 30 years, we have created this, really this environment, this culture for our students that, you know, all students have to go to college. So here's what happened. In 1985, we awarded about 980,000 bachelor degrees to the United States. In 2012, 1.8 million. During the same time, we increased the number of engineers in the United States from 77,000 to 81,000. The number of computer science and information science majors from 42,000 to 47,000, and the number of visual and performing art majors from 36,000 to 95,000. And what I'd suggest to you is it's not just about degrees, it's about skills. And this skill development begins at a very early age. Students make decisions whether they're good in math and science as early as second grade. We turn them off these subjects, it's really difficult to turn them on at some point in the future. We want to know why don't students take computer science? It's because they've never been introduced to computer science. And then we think they're going to get excited about it when they're in high school. We have to get to our students early. We have to inspire them. Students come to school with this natural curiosity. They want to learn. They want to play. And then we teach them how to do school. We teach them how to comply, how to follow the rules, how to get by. Those that do get a high school diploma. Those that excel, they go on to do great things. I would say that's a very small percentage of our students, and we have to do better. But we can. Right? Howard Gardner says, however, that the greatest deficit in American education of our students is their inability to apply learning in a context in which it wasn't learned, that we teach everything in isolation. Students learn math in the math hallway, science in the science hallway, but STEM is something very different. It's not a course you go to, but it's an integrated approach in how students have to apply math and science in rigorous but relevant ways. And when learning becomes relevant for our students get excited. All of a sudden, that curiosity becomes even greater. Students ask questions. And we tell our teachers in Project Lead the Way, you know you've arrived as a teacher when students are asking you questions which you have no idea what the answer is. Right? That's learning. And that's new knowledge. It's what happens in companies. Companies every day in R&D are asking questions they don't have an answer to. They just know there's a problem they need to solve. And we go through this iterative process to design, develop drugs and cures. Right? And then we come up with great solutions. Learning is exactly the same thing. That's how we discover. And that's why we're here. To figure out how do we not only align vertically, but how do we coordinate across the state to continue to distinguish the state in many respects. So with that, we have a great panel ahead of us. But before we get to the panel, I want to, you have introductions in our program and the biographies of all of our great panelists, but I want to introduce Ann Shane. Ann is a consultant to BioCrossroads, but more than that, she is a distinguished leader in our state and has led us in many respects, but a passionate educator, a believer in not only the promise of our state, but the promise of our children. So, Ann, we'd like to hear from you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Vince. He says most of that because I'm from Evansville, so you know we all stick together. Before I make my remarks, there are some people that I need to single out because none of what I'm getting ready to talk about would have happened without Dr. Paul Ainsley, who is at Purdue at the iSTEM Resource Center, without his colleagues. Yes. Stand up, Paul. You need to stand up. Bill Walker and Brandon Sorge, and let me just say that we've all been working so long together that Brandon Sorge now has his PhD. That's a long time. The other person that I want to recognize is Sherry Bossing from Lilly Company, because if you ever want to do something and you want to get like a nuclear bomb behind it, then you get in touch with Sherry, and she's brought an amazing level of energy, talent, and I think industry knowledge to all of the things that we've been doing at BioCrossroads around STEM. So Sherry deserves a huge hand. And Steve Kleinman sitting next to her, he's a retired Lilly employee. I believe he's a chemical engineer. And he's been leading the science coach effort in Indianapolis. So that has been amazing. And he deserves some credit for that, too. So lots of applause for him so he won't feel bad. And then the other person I want to recognize is Karen Morris from the University of Notre Dame, who started out life as their chemistry outreach coordinator, and Dr. Joyce Johnston, who headed the ACE program at Notre Dame. But Karen, working together on the National Math and Science Initiative grant we were able to bring to Indiana, has coordinated that AP program here with tremendous results. So Karen Morris, wherever you are, yes. So I had to recognize them. I just quickly, 10 years ago when we kind of started out on this, we had to start thinking what were some things we could do in Indiana around STEM education, because it's by far has the broadest interest, through any sector that is involved in our economy or public sector, private sector, philanthropic sector, research, startup, mature industry, whatever. Everybody was saying we've got to do something. So the question was, what could we do that would really make a difference? And it doesn't take long to go through the research and find out teachers, are the most important component. So what we tried to do was figure out how could we invest in the success of our teachers. That was really kind of our primary focus. How could we find some existing programs, like Project Lead the Way, for instance, that was really focused on investing in professional development and investing in the teachers who interact with our students and who really, have the most influence on their successful outcomes. We also wanted to see the use of more inquiry-based, research-proven curricula around the state. We wanted to see a lot of data collection and accountability measures, because the people who are giving us money to fund a lot of these things want to know if they work, and they don't consider that to be an unreasonable request. The other thing we found out, and I think Vince alluded to that too, we found a big white space around science education in K-8, and that's really where the iSTEM Resource Center has focused, along with Lilly Company, on K-8 science education. If you look at the NEAT scores and you see over 60% of our kids leave eighth grade less than proficient in math and science, it's no wonder that, we're not seeing a larger percentage of them go on post-secondarily or even in high school, into some kind of STEM-related profession. So something's happening in K-8, and I think that's why you're seeing Project Lead the Way, AP, other programs trying to figure out how can they extend farther downward into the pipeline, because we think those kids are turning away, and I don't know the answer, but I'm guessing a lot of them are girls, during that period, and how can we strengthen that. We also wanted to leverage and connect existing STEM activity. We found there were STEM centers in almost every higher ed institution in the state of Indiana, kind of out doing their own thing. So if we could create a network, provide professional development, create some standards around that, that seemed to be a ready-made avenue. And the main thing we wanted to do was we wanted to support programs that were going to set a high bar of achievement. In other words, they're interfacing with industry or higher education and saying, what do we need to do to prepare our students to get you where you need to see them? Not Stephanie and I have a conversation saying, how are we doing? Stephanie would be like, we're doing great, okay. So that was very important, just to keep pushing the bar higher in Indiana. So we came down to kind of three activities. If you could show the next slide, please. We did support Project Lead the Way in the development of its new biomedical science curriculum. It was new when we started 10 years ago. The other thing that we did was we felt that supporting AP, particularly in the areas of STEM, was very critically important. Again, an existing program, lots of investment in professional development, provides kids with the opportunity to earn college credit early, or at least demonstrate to them, if they're a non-traditional AP student, that they have the capacity to go on to post-secondary training. And then the iSTEM Resource Network, which we founded in partnership with Purdue and with tremendous support from the Lilly Endowment and also from the Lilly Company Foundation. So again, their focus has really been more on the Indiana Science Initiative. Started out actually with middle school math as that moved down from ninth grade, and then focused more on science K-8. The results, that's what we're always kind of interested in. So the AP program, and Joyce And Karen and I probably worked for 4 years to get this National Math and Science Initiative investment in Indiana. But jointly, we've probably raised about $10 million for advanced placement courses in math, science, and English AP in Indiana. The number of students taking AP, and this is, we're just in year three of this program, has gone from 2,500 to over 10,000. But the real question you need to ask is, how many of these students who have taken this test have produced a qualifying score? So at least in year one and year two, for which we have data, the qualifying scores have also tripled. And we've also been able to reach 261 math, science teachers and English teachers in 30 schools across the state. So these are not really focused on the high-end, suburban, high achievers, but, you know, it's a very broad cross-section. So the other thing that we've done is, again, supported the Indiana Science Initiative, and we've probably raised about $10 million of private money for K-8 inquiry-based science instruction, provided professional development for over 2,000 K-8 science teachers, engaged with over 51,000 students statewide, delivered over 4 tons of science materials to support kit refurbishments because the schools couldn't figure out how to do that. That's all done at Purdue. And raised science and ELA ISEP from below average to above average in the schools where ISI has been implemented. So if you consider this, BioCrossroads, and again, with all my colleagues in the room, has helped to raise or leverage almost $20 million in private money of support in the last 8 to 10 years for these STEM programs. And don't forget that private dollars also provide major support for Project Lead the Way. And then two of our biggest pipelines, and they're pretty small, for STEM teachers who really have subject area expertise, that's Teach for America and the Woodrow Wilson Fellows. So what are the next steps for Indiana? We feel, and I think you heard Rob mention this earlier, you know, we need a highly visible statewide STEM strategy for Indiana. We see this in a number of other states, Alabama, Tennessee. I mean, you know, just go down the line. I think it's been extraordinarily effective, but and we need something that continues to support rigorous STEM education, but all this has to happen at a very high level. So we're down here kind of doing our thing as best we can, but we need a strategy that is being led by an organization or an entity or a consortium of folks, particularly with some relationship to the public sector, because the private sector is now saying, we've been funding a lot of this stuff for a long time on the theory. We would lead the way. We would pilot this. We would demonstrate results. And then we would see public investment follow over the long term to create a bar that would continue to raise. And so the private sector is saying, we've stepped up. We've done our part. Now we need some partners to come in and help put together an effective strategy that will help us understand how we can best invest going forward. So that's where we are, and that's the call to action we'd like to make at this point in time.
Great. Thank you, Ann. Earlier you were introduced to Rob Smith, a great friend, a great leader in our state, and Rob will be on our panel today. And I'd also like to introduce two other panelists that will join us. Dr. Dina Cushenberry has been a public education for over 32 years. She started her career with MSD of Warren Township in 1999. During that time, she has been assistant principal at the middle school level and principal at the elementary level. She opened Liberty Park Elementary School in 2002 and 2003 school year. In 2008, she moved to central office where she served as associate and deputy superintendent from 2008 to 2012 and was appointed superintendent of schools in April of 2012. Dr. Cushenberry, thank you for joining us.
Sure.
And our other panelist has a distinguished early career as well. Stephanie Bothan received a Bachelor of Science Finance from the IU Kelly School of Business. She taught 8th grade math at Willard Gambold Junior High School in Indianapolis Public Schools. She assumed the role of 8th grade team leader during her second year in the classroom, led her students to 32% growth on ISTEP, and was named Teach for America's Indianapolis Teacher of the Year. Stephanie, thanks for joining us. So, Ann, I'm going to come back to you. You talk about these efforts and the things that are happening. You know. So when you think of coordination, how coordinated are these efforts today from your perspective?
You know, I think they are somewhat coordinated. I know Paul, again, has been a real leader in kind of bringing together a broad cross-section of people who meet on a regular basis, try to discuss some critical policy issues. But as far as a really unified vision in the state for STEM and where those weaknesses in the pipeline are and how we address those, one being the K-8 issue, which I mentioned earlier, and then how public money, in addition to private and philanthropic money, invests to create, you know, some long-term change. I don't see that right now. I don't see that we have that.
I'm interested in a comment you made during your opening remarks, and that is that businesses and others who have made these type of investments are asking for results. You suggested that that was an acceptable expectation. What results are they looking for? What are the true outcomes that people are interested in achieving through this kind of coordinated effort?
Are you asking me that question
yes.
again? Gosh, I think it's time for the other panelists to chime in.
Or if anyone else wants to join or answer that question, is it?
I think, you know, there are a couple of things. First of all, their employees all seem to be incredibly interested in STEM education and in assisting in some way. But they need a very specific, prescribed avenue that is set up to maximize their time in order to do something like that. Then the next thing I think that they're thinking to see is that this is going to pay off in a better trained workforce, and then also their ability to attract talent into the state, because these are so many of them are global, you know, companies. And they want to know that if they move to Indiana, their kids are going to have access to a quality education. So I think all those are part of the virtuous cycle.
Great. Ann, no, I'll move on to someone else.
Yes, please.
Rob, if you're really interested, you talk from a business perspective.
Right.
How important is it for this common voice, for people to come together and collaborate from a business perspective?
Yeah, it's critically important, Vince, that we increasingly do that. And I think that the business community is in the philanthropic community is trying to do a better job of aligning philanthropic resources around programs and efforts that have the best opportunity to drive results that matter to teachers and to kids and ultimately to employers throughout the state of Indiana. But I think that we need to do more. And Ann did a very good job summarizing, I think, a lot of the great work that has been done to date through the iSTEM Resource Network and other organizations. I think that we are much better off because of the work that has been done to date. But I think what we need to do next is to have a statewide STEM strategy that is visible and that we're all singing from the same page. Now, centralized planning and democracies is not easy to do, and it's sort of anathema to us. But I think that we really need to do the hard work of bringing the right stakeholders around the table to have a statewide strategy around STEM. And then it will be the obligation of the business community to make sure that we are lending support to that, we're advocating for that, and we're aligning our resources behind that state strategy to drive real results.
I'm also interested in your perspective. Oftentimes we talk about Lilly and
right.
you know, major companies, but there's this entire ecosystem. There's a supply chain. There's
That's right.
small businesses. How do you think they can get involved and really start driving change?
It's really an excellent question. I think it in many ways, and others have talked about this, Lieutenant Governor talked about it in her comments. I do think it starts with getting your people involved in schools or out-of-school programs to get kids excited about science and math. I mean, these are wondrous subjects, and all of us in this room can do our part to get kids excited about math and science and mentor. And I think that is a great avenue to be able to get smaller companies engaged in this discussion. I'm reminded of one of my favorite quotes of a guy named Jacob Bernowski, who did a great documentary in the 1970s called The Ascent of Man, and he was asked about what is science. And he said, ask an impertinent question, and you're on the road to a pertinent answer. That's the essence of science. Mm-hmm. And if you've been around young kids, you know they are full of impertinent questions. And we need to, all of us, and not just teachers and administrators, but all of us around these children need to encourage that kind of curiosity and that kind of excitement. And in the process, we're going to be teaching them not just what the scientific method is all about, but really where I think America has its comparative advantage, and that's our ability to innovate and create and come up with new ideas. We need to foster that in our young kids. And I think that's a way for other companies, other organizations to get involved, is to get your people engaged and tap into their passion and capabilities.
Great, thank you. Dr. Cushenberry, when you think about STEM education in your district, could you kind of share with us some of the things you're working on and how STEM education is having an effect on your students?
Sure. I'd say back in 2012, we wrote a Race to the Top grant. We were one of 16 districts in the nation to receive that grant. And I will tell you, when we started writing, we talked about personalized learning. We talked about college and career readiness. And we were in flux with what we were going to do here in Indiana with our college and career ready standards. But what I look at is our Project Lead the Way program in our Career Center, which has truly done wonderful things for our students. We had some of our students who have gone to Germany, and actually we have a team right now stuck in Chicago who are headed back to Germany to compete internationally with their it's an ice cream machine this year. Last year it was a nano machine, which was a pill dispenser. The kids created a band that would go around a client's arm, and then this dispenser would dispense pills every 20 minutes or when the patient needed it. If the patient did not or client did not take the medication, it would notify the doctor or a family member. And so, you know, our kids have been truly creative with some of the activities they've been able to do with Project Lead the Way. But the other thing is, if you really want a true workforce, you really have to start at the kindergarten level and start working up. I mean, it starts early, early, early. I hear a lot of people talk about ninth grade, but it starts not even in the middle school. It starts in elementary, that late elementary, really helping kids foster that love for exploration and creativity and, you know, collaborating. The thing about our former test, and I'll be quiet, I promise, was, you know, we really train kids to find the right answer. And so what we're finding now with this new assessment, kids want the right answer. And no longer will this new college and career readiness prepare them just to find the right answer. It will say, okay, now you have the answer, what's the next answer? And now that you have this, what can you do with this? And so I'm extremely excited with about the new college career readiness standards. I'm excited about what we're doing with Project Lead the Way. We're working with companies like Dow, Lilly, Community Hospital. They've done wonderful internships for our kids. We have a Front Runner production company, which the mayor's office has done their robotics through our kids. Next to professionals, they're learning some really interesting real-world experiences. We've worked with Adidas, so we're excited about what's happening in Warren Township, not Wayne. We're in the Thank you.
I did say Warren Township.
You did, but in the book it says Wayne.
You talk about the companies you work with. How important is this alignment for you from a district perspective of aligning in higher education and employers?
Well, there's an expertise that comes with the employers. And then there's the new knowledge that our kids have to have. And then there's that whole piece of funding, you know, and it has to be thoughtful. And I liked what Ann said about, you know, people want results. And so it's only fair to expect that. But I think with the universities, with employers, there's that expertise, new knowledge that our kids are learning, and then they're able to apply what it is that they're expected to do. Right now, you know, finding the right answer, but applying what you do and making it relevant for kids is truly where we need to go. And I think that's what they'll have experience doing when they're in the businesses.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you. Stephanie, you are the Director of Education Initiatives for the City of Indianapolis. And one of the things you've been directly involved with and is with Vex Robotics, mm-hmm. Vex Championships and so forth. Now, what do you see working and implementing those type of experiences for students and also about organizations and initiatives like US 2020?
Sure. First, just wanted to say thanks so much for the introduction, and I'm really honored to be here. I've learned most of what I know from the people in this room. We've got Laura Dodds, Debbie, we already mentioned Paul, so just a great group of people in this room. But as you mentioned, currently my role, I work for the mayor, and the mayor's vision is that all children have access to an education that enables them to define their own life path. So we start with high-quality early childhood education, which we had a big victory for on Monday night, which we're super excited about. Thanks in large part to Rob Smith and others. But then we continue with a system of K-12 options that meet diverse students' needs. And then we continue on to workforce development. So determining how can we make sure that supply of talent can come out matching the demands that we have from employers. So I don't want to beat a dead horse with some of these statistics, but a few of the statistics that were really interesting to our office as we went through this process and we were determining how we wanted to spend our time was that first, one of the statistics nationally is that there's only one job available for every 5 unemployed people in non-STEM subjects, but 2.4 jobs available for every 1 non-employed STEM person. So we know we have a huge opportunity if we get our talent to have those skills, to have lots more opportunities for jobs. In addition, we looked at the Brookings report, actually, and in 2013, there were thousands of STEM jobs available right here in the city of Indianapolis with an average salary of over $55,000 a year, which is over $10,000 above the median wage for a family of 4 in the city of Indianapolis. So it's an imperative that we get our students the skills that they need in order to get into those jobs. So that pipeline was a huge priority for the mayor. So what I wanted to understand and what the mayor wanted to understand were what are some of the reasons that students are not pursuing these careers. So there was a study done out of the University of Virginia that asked students that question. So why aren't they going into these different subjects? And they highlighted 2 main reasons overwhelmingly. One, they don't understand what people do in STEM fields. They don't understand what the work looks like. 2, they don't know anybody who works in those fields. So those are 2 of the causes that we talk a lot about in our office around how can we address both causes that have students not going into the fields. So robotics, the mayor is very passionate about robotics. So 3 years ago, he saw a robotics event happening just south of the city. He saw the engagement of the students. He saw that they were pushing their teachers and parents aside and trying to solve problems. They were working together. And when he saw that competition, he said, I just want every student to have access to this. So in our first year with robotics, we had 38 high school teams only that participated. And this last November, we had over 125 teams, over 800 students, and over 5,000 people from the public attend that event. And I think it's just a testament to how hungry students and schools are for these types of programs. Also, we want robotics, STEM, academic pursuits to be at the same level as the sporting pursuits are. We know most people aren't going to be the next LeBron James or Michael Jordan, but we know we have lots of STEM jobs that are available for those students. And so we do our event at Bankers Life Fieldhouse. The mayor does a huge, we have the largest trophy, I think, in the state. It's about 5 feet tall. And the mayor goes out to each school and re-presents those trophies in front of an assembly of their peers so that those students are elevated to the same level as a lot of the sports types pursuits at schools. So we see robotics as a great opportunity. It's not the only opportunity. It's just one of the opportunities. But if we can break down barriers, if we can provide financial resources to schools, we can help them find mentors from our corporate sponsors, such as Roche Diagnostics, who's been our core sponsor from the very beginning, and also Project Lead the Way and many others, Lily, then they're much more likely to choose those subjects going forward and then ultimately have the opportunity in college to choose those experiences as well. Do you want me to talk about US 2020?
Sure.
No, go ahead.
No, I think the point, too, is that the market signaling is very important for students and for parents. That we can share, I think that's another important role of industry and companies. Mm-hmm. Say, we have great opportunities for your children. And then connecting the educational experience with those kind of opportunities is very important. So it's So when you think of, take US 2020, talk a little more about that. Other complementary types of experiences.
Sure. One more thing about robotics, because I love it so much that I forgot to mention, is just the student impact, and I'll talk about US 2020. We had a student, and it made me think of a couple of the comments we've heard today, who actually was at Walker Career Center and was not very engaged in ninth grade and just felt ninth and tenth grade, didn't really understand how all the work connected. Joined the robotics team and then did an interview with media last year saying, oh, I actually understand how physics matters and why it matters. And now I want to go to Purdue and be an engineer. So I think that's just a testament of the program and the impact it can have. But switching over to US 2020, so another thing that Anne's talked a little bit about today is we have lots of STEM happening, and that's incredibly important. We think there's lots of great efforts happening. But US 2020 was a call from President Obama in the White House to deploy 1 million STEM mentors into schools and programs across the country. Because as I mentioned earlier, there's those two causes for why students don't go into STEM careers, one of them being mentors. We need them to have an understanding of what that pathway can look like and what that career can look like. And so TechPoint Foundation for Youth took the lead on being the project manager of coordinating a steering committee to get us all together to say, how can we figure out a plan to go about getting more STEM mentors from our corporate partners and universities into our high-quality STEM programs? And so we put together a plan. There was over 50 cities that applied, and we were chosen as one of seven that were the winning cities for that initiative. And so that's really a testament to TechPoint's work. But what we proposed was not rocket science, which we talk about a lot. All we were trying to do was say, you have a market. So you have mentors that work at companies, you have schools, and you have high-quality STEM programs. So what we proposed was figuring out, how do you bring all those parties together in a way that creates choice? So how do schools find STEM programs that meet their needs? How do mentors get connected with those programs in those schools? And so we have a portal that we're working on right now that brings all of those parties together. So we're in a pilot year right now where we're working with a few school districts, a few corporate partners, and we're trying to build out what that portal looks like and what the mechanisms look like so that that can eventually go statewide. But that type of effort, I think, is similar to what Rob has talked about, what Lieutenant Governor Ellsperman talked about. We just need to have these coordinated, larger scale efforts that help bring it together in a way that we can all digest and then have information to spit back out to our employers and to our schools around what's happening in the state. So I'm excited to be a part of that effort, and I think it'll continue to be something you'll hear about over the next few years as we figure out the model and try to scale it statewide.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, we have a couple questions that we're going to ask the panel in just about 5 minutes or so. We're going to open to questions from all of you. So get your questions ready. But I've heard a number of things, such as coordination, alignment, K-12, higher ed. What are the next steps? How do we convene the people that need to be at the table to really drive this effort forward and to get a strategy on paper that we can execute? Anyone?
From my perspective, and I'd be curious to get the opinions of the other panelists and others in the audience, but I think that convening of the right stakeholders at the right level with the right degree of influence to drive us forward is the critical next step. And I'm glad that we are here at a BioCrossroads Central Indiana Corporate Partnership event, because in my judgment, this is probably the ideal organization to be able to take that next step and convene the right stakeholders from the philanthropic community, the education community, state government, business community, to be able to have a highly visible, highly credible strategy that we can align around. So I really think that is, in my judgment, the immediate next step that has to come out of our discussion today.
That's right, and that's why we're here today, so we can publicly put David Johnson on the spot.
Yeah, I don't think David was listening.
but I think there is a concern,
David,
too, that, you know, there is. We're very fortunate in Indianapolis to have many employers and philanthropies who are very concerned about this. I think there are other models around the state. They come into Columbus, but the question is, do we have a statewide strategy that can help lift, you know, the boats everywhere around Indiana that don't have the same resource base? How do we make that happen in some of the more rural schools and some of the smaller cities? I mean, you know, their futures are going to depend on their ability to have a better trained workforce, I think. So that's a concern.
The only thing I would add to that is I think just understanding what's working and how do we take that group of people and try to replicate and grow what's working and then target investments to make sure that we're actually moving the needle. So one question we ask a lot in Indianapolis is, are we moving the needle for this gap? We think we are. We think we're doing a number of different initiatives, but the data is a little bit harder to come by. So that infrastructure piece of figuring out how do we track it and actually understand what that gap is and how we're addressing it and get some data around that, I think it's going to be really important too for that group.
You know, it's interesting when I think we've answered questions like, why does this matter and who cares?
Yeah.
We know it matters and we know a lot of people care about it. I think bringing people together is going to be central to this effort. And, you know, there's this whole idea of shared value,
right,
and understanding that, you know, those benefits accrue on multiple levels, right? And people can come from different perspectives. But then there's this collective impact.
Right.
You know, what happens exponentially when we bring a number of people together, we're going to be able to accomplish a lot more than anyone's going to accomplish by themselves.
Right.
And K-12 education can't do this work alone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but we also have to get the metrics right.
Right.
And understand what we're really trying to do. What are the outcomes that we're pursuing? So we're talking about STEM professionals, people that are going into this pipeline. How do we measure that? And how do we measure the actual skills? So I'll give you one example, and I'm going to lead to my next question. I was in a state recently, and the governor's office suggested to me that the way they wanted to improve math and science in their state was to require another year of math and science. And I said, well, so why is that? He said, we need to improve our NAEP scores, and we want to do better, you know, on international assessments. And I said, you know, did it ever occur to you by this time the students take that additional math and science course, they've already taken all those exams? You know, that nothing is really going to change by requiring students to do more of the same.
Right.
And I'm concerned that we start to test more of the same.
Right.
And how can we start to align metrics from a career readiness perspective at the state to the kind of outcomes that we actually desire?
Yeah, well, if you can figure that out.
I know, that is a great question.
You will be king of the world, pope, emperor, no.
Like another book.
Yes.
No,
I
think one thing that, you know, I was an Ivy Tech trustee for 10 years, and one thing that really very much concerned me, because we're talking more about the middle skill folks here, which is a huge gap as well, but the number of students that come to Ivy Tech that are not prepared to do college level work in a community college is an astonishing number. That to me is an intervention point that, you know, has never been fully explored. Why are these kids not prepared? Why, you know, what exactly, and most of the time it's math. I mean, there's a lot of English, but math is a real issue. And then how do you work that back through the pipeline? So, you know, that would be to me a big indicator. How many of your kids come to college, students come to college prepared to do, you know, some post-secondary work, because we know that's a requirement in our economy going forward.
Yeah. And he also has this longitudinal data system that can be very important for us.
Right.
How we connect pre-K to career.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Let's take your questions.
We don't quite have.
Yes, please.
What is a stellar panel. I have to admit I'm from an informal learning venue, so full disclosure.
Connor Prairie.
Yes. you have all focused your attention on school.
Right.
And yet we've heard that kids make decisions about their career by second grade. And the research of Dr. Kevin Crowley at the University of Pittsburgh has shown that that most STEM professionals now became inspired from out-of-classroom learning experiences. I know my own children have been. Have you thought at all about creating more places that kids can discover on their own? And what was the quote? Kindle the curiosity to make them passionate about learning, which
right.
is practically our mission statement.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been any discussion about that?
There's, you know, Paul should really speak to that, because some of the discussion groups that he's learned, you know, have really tried to focus on more of these out-of-school learning experiences. I think the problem, the trick bag you get into is we spend half our state budget,
right.
$6 billion on K through 12 education. And so, you know, that's such a huge chunk, and everyone wants to see performance because you're still going to need students with basic skills, even if they're very passionate. So I think we do get caught up in that trap, but I think, Ellen, you bring up an excellent point. How does that play into part of our overall strategy? And I think it gets left out.
Yeah, I agree.
You need better thinking on that.
And to your point as well, that's one of the things we did at Project Lead the Way, is partner with Connor Prairie and offering programs, working with Boys and Girl Scouts. And that was one of the key parts of our elementary launch program, is to find a more flexible model that could be applied in many settings, even with homeschool students or another informal learning experience. So I think it's a critical question and very important for us to be able to answer.
Yeah, I agree. Well, let's go ahead and get some other questions. I think Ann did a good job addressing
them. Yes, go ahead, please.
I wondered if there was a particular state that people have been looking at that has dealt with this issue already, that we could look at models.
Yeah, there are 49 of them.
But there are some that have been more successful at the coordinated efforts that I think the panel is talking about.
I mean, the one that we've all visited a lot is the Alabama program, known in the South as AMSTI. The Alabama Association. You know, I think Tennessee, I think a lot of these states, Rhode Island is another one, but it's so tiny, and it's basically whatever DuPont wants to do happens, but which makes it a lot easier. But all of the states that we've looked at, and Paul, you might want to throw out some more, or Sherry.
Certainly Iowa is a model close to home, Indiana, but Arizona, California, Texas, fairly well-organized states with STEM.
Yeah, but with usually a lot of support from the governor. Yeah. I mean, you know, who's actually going out and, you know, this is a mantra. So we have not seen, I'm not criticizing anybody, I'm just saying we haven't seen leadership at that level, and that's what we're suggesting probably needs to happen.
The states that we work in, you mentioned, California right now, things are really moving in a specific way, driven by economic development. And that's, I think, another interesting piece of this is, from a community perspective, bringing on economic development, workforce development, and others that can not only align mission, but also other resources, you know, rather than people working independently. So, yes, sir.
I would just like to say I'm really excited that you're making this announcement about a statewide strategy, because the work that the iSTEM resource, actually the Action Coalition, has put together has a lot of really smart people who have done things around not-for-profit, profit, government, higher education. And now just having this forum to have something of credibility to really support it, along with other initiatives, is going to be, I think we're going to be able to really skyrocket Indiana as a result of the work that's been done. So I'm really excited about this.
Great. Thank you, Sherry.
Okay, so you guys all mentioned the importance of measuring whether or not our efforts are moving the needle. That's something that I know my organization is very interested in, because time and resources are very valuable, and our employees want to make sure that they're doing the right things when they're out volunteering. So how are you guys measuring the impact? And are you guys focused more on qualitative or quantitative data?
Yeah, we're focused more on quantitative data. And I will have to say, you know, we've had some very robust discussions on that issue, because there is a wide range of opinion within the education community on how you assess results. But let me just say, our funders are saying, we want to see student achievement scores go up. You can measure everything else that you want to, but that's what we want to see. So I think, you know, we have to be intermediaries between business and philanthropy, who are used to looking at hard data and hard numbers, and the education community, which often wants to explore a much broader set of metrics. So again, that's why we pick some of the programs we support, like Project Lead the Way. I mean, you know, the data there is very robust on their successes. You can get on their website, you can see it. AP, the same thing. You take the test, you have a qualifying score. Then are you going on to college? I mean, we want to know all these things. ISI, are the science student achievement scores going up? You know, it's been our focus.
So follow up, you guys mentioned that early education is kind of the key target audience that we're reaching for. And I do agree with that. However, if we're looking at achievement scores later on and whether or not kids are going to college, how are you tracking that progress?
There's a national clearinghouse that tracks that information for us. So you can go and find out for Warren Township how many have gone over time. So from you have lots of longitudinal data on that.
So. But Indiana is still behind on assigning every student a unique number, like they do, say, in Florida, and tracking you all through the system. There have been a lot of fits and starts, and the other thing I will have to say is we only test science periodically in Indiana, and that's a real issue because then schools don't allocate resources and support to science the way they do to math and English.
Well, and you pay attention to what
was
mandated, but you know we're getting in ready to switch over to a new test, and so the idea of introducing another annual test at this point in time we know is. It's probably low, but the new test is going to be harder with higher standards, and you're going to see lower scores. So another reason to have a strategy to,
you know
start looking.
It only takes 18 hours to take.
No, right. No, and, you know, the other thing about, and I like that, Anne, because this new exam is going to really shock the systems of a lot of our kids. We've had a couple of the readiness tests, and our... I would say Excel students, as we call them, AP kids, are just like, wow. Mm-hmm. And some of the parents are you sure? And I said, hey, your kids are still smart. They're just shifting their learning, and it's going to take about 3 to 5 years for that to happen. And it's okay, you know, but this is their baseline, and will they grow from here?
Yeah, very good point.
So.
Yes, please. I'm going to introduce myself since I'm new to this town. My name is Kai Schleyer. I'm the director of the Center for Biomedical Informatics at the Regenship Institute. Stephanie mentioned a key word in the whole discussion, which is you said there's a market. So we have supply and demand, but the question we have to ask ourselves, is it an efficient market? And my assertion would be no.
Mm-hmm. No.
Last week, I signed 5 requisitions for interns in our center. Where do we go to... You know, where's the efficiency in finding the people? Because I know there's 20 people who fit what mm-hmm. I'm looking for mm-hmm. perfectly, but they don't know these requisitions exist, mm-hmm. and I don't have a good way mm-hmm. to get to them. So I think when we think about how, you know, the new economy, the app economy transforms
mm-hmm. right.
what's around us, you know, think Angie's List, Uber.
Right.
There are ways to make the market a whole lot more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, how do we attract the attention for this issue?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a key challenge for everyone.
Yeah,
it's a great point.
Talk to Stephanie or Laura, though. They should be able to help you with that.
Yeah, Peter, Peter Capelli wrote a book. He's a professor at Wharton, and it's called Why Good People Can't Get a Job. It's really interesting. Now, he takes on the whole skills gap issue, but below the surface, there's something even more fundamental, and it's like, how do we connect people?
That's right.
You know, there are geographic issues. You know, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal just a month or so ago suggesting that students coming out of college today are selecting which city they want to live in before they get a job.
Right, yeah.
They know where they want to live.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of other issues around not only training people up, but also attracting people, keeping people in various locations.
Mm-hmm.
He even talks about the HR algorithms that are built into HR systems
mm-hmm.
that filter people that are highly qualified. It's like if you expect 10 years of experience for someone, but they only have 9.5, they're out.
Yes.
You know, and how do we get smarter about that? So we have time for one more question.
Great
question.
I'm Matt Morse with Franklin College, and I'm just curious, what do you see as the role of a small liberal arts college has been done for journalism and teachers, but science is our largest field of study right now.
Mm-hmm.
A third of the students are first generation,
mm-hmm.
most of them stay in Indiana. So how do we be a part of this discussion, and more broadly, what's the role of smaller global arts schools?
I think there's a tremendous opportunity for teacher preparation.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's really where we're all doing kind of sort of a lot of workarounds on that, right? You know, we're all investing in professional development through AP, through Project Lead the Way, through the Indiana Science Initiative. And if there were a college who was willing to take on, you know, maybe a different type of teacher preparation and or professional ongoing professional development, particularly focused on STEM or teaching, say, in an urban, teaching STEM in an urban setting, I mean, I think the sky is the limit for that.
I completely agree with that, Ann. And one other thing that I would add to that, I think oftentimes these discussions around STEM were led to a false dichotomy that the liberal arts and other things don't matter. And that's not true. I mean, we need to figure out how to do both of these things really well and integrate them. I was talking to one of our senior people at Lilly, and I asked him, who's a brilliant scientist but also a great leader of people, I said, what does it take to be successful in the scientific community at Lilly? And he said, we need to hire people who can work well and lead others, but most importantly, we need people who don't have a fear of failure. And I think that, you know, if we're talking about STEM all the time, we're talking about testing all the time, we can't forget about integrating liberal arts and asking big questions and setting hypotheses in the context of a person's education. Because when you go to work at a company like Lilly, we need the baseline capabilities in biology and chemistry, but we also need people to test hypotheses and to push the envelope and come up with new ideas. And I think that small liberal arts colleges like Franklin have a great opportunity to be able to integrate those things into the STEM curriculum and prepare students for the workforce of tomorrow. So it's an excellent question.
Just to add tactically too, I think like any college, you have a huge human capital pipeline at your disposal. So any ways that you can push that down and support K-12, teachers, students, mentoring programs. We want lots of talent from our local universities to be involved in everything they can in the city. So I think just Rob talked kind of about that other type of integration. I think vertically too, like supporting down into the K-12 system is a great way to get involved.
Please join me in again thanking our distinguished panel.
Our distinguished panel. No.
Yay!
David, again, thank you for the great work about Crossroads, your leadership, and I'll turn it back to you. Thank you.
Caught me playing hooky the one time I get volunteered for something. Thank you very much. Vince, thank you very much for your leadership of the panel, for keeping us right on time, which is a hallmark of these events. This has been I think you see in these four people and in Vince as well. I mean, there's passion and there's pragmatism in this, and it's really exciting to have this kind of topic and conversation with this kind of leadership that we're seeing. There's really abundant leadership here, and again, the need is to pull that together. When everybody's talking about statewide, I just want to make clear what I see or what I hear in that concept. It is not only getting a lot of actors around the state involved, it is translating this into state programs, into state curriculum, into state policy. So this is actually beginning to have some measure of this being not just pilot programs, not just a one-off venture here or a plan here or there, but really pulling this together into a unified statewide strategy. So obviously this involves a broader conversation of policymakers and then philanthropic and corporate leaders and community leaders. CICP does have a history of convening some conversations like that around other areas. We've done that in several instances in the past. This is a really large topic, but I think we will step up to that challenge. We think it's important to do, and I've spoken already with several of you here about that. So we will be continuing this conversation. We will probably do it through having more series like these. We'll do some other things too, but this kind of a frameworks discussion is very important. Brings a lot of good people forward, brings a lot of you out, and we want to find a way to engage everybody going forward on this very, very important topic. I want to thank Lieutenant Governor again for coming today. She's going to clearly be a critical part of everything we do going forward from here. I want to thank our sponsors, Miles Printing and Purdue University, and we will have more framework sessions on other topics throughout the year here as well. I can't exactly tell you. I'm looking at Lori. Do we have a date for the next one yet? We don't. But stay tuned. You're all on our list. And we look forward to seeing you again very soon and again to continuing this conversation in the near future. Thanks very much.